Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's the U.S. saying, we can't do this alone. We cannot deter both Russia and China alone. We need allies and partners like Australia.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, Lisa Curtis, Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, joins Will Stoltz and David Andrews from the college to discuss the U.S. national security strategy recently released by the Biden administration. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past and present.
Lisa, thank you for joining David and I at the National Security College for a discussion.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's very fortuitous to be able to have you in person in Canberra at the time of this recording because, as many of our listeners will know, the Biden administration has just released the latest national security strategy, which I understand you were involved quite closely in producing the last national security strategy. So you've got a real first-person insight into how these important kind of keystone documents are crafted. There's a myriad of different things that David and I want to explore with this strategy, but we thought perhaps the first place to start, particularly for an Australian audience, would be to just give us an understanding of what actually is a national security strategy in the US context, who's responsible for developing it, how frequently are they put out, that sort of thing, because they are kind of an unusual feature compared with the Australian system.
Well, the national security strategy is actually very important in the U.S. context. And usually a new administration, when they come in, that's one of their top priorities is issuing a national security strategy. And as you mentioned, when I was in the Trump administration, the Trump administration actually was able to publish its national security strategy quite early, December 2017. So, less than a year into its time in office. And basically, the national security staff contributes to this document. Well, actually, all of the U.S. government, but it's really written and drafted and organized by the national security staff. And they bring together all arms of the U.S. government, Department of Defense, State Department, Department of Commerce, to basically identify the priorities that the administration, that particular administration, will take. And then once it is issued, it becomes the sort of planning document and the driver for everything the administration is going to do on national security. So it's very important in setting the tone and the priorities of each administration. So the Biden administration took a little bit of time in issuing its national security strategy almost 2 years into its administration, but they did issue the interim guidelines, which came out about a year and a half ago, actually, in the spring of 2021. So they did have their general approach laid out for the U.S. public. But it is quite an important document. It's worth paying attention to. It's worth reading because it will tell you the priorities of this administration and what direction it's going in.
Yeah, I'll let David jump in a moment. I just wanted to, ask, because you were so closely involved in the previous administration's strategy, I mean, what are perhaps the key features of continuity, but also the key features of difference in this strategy, noting, of course, that, the world has changed in some pretty dramatic ways since the 2017 strategy.
Well, that's right. I think in 2017, there was a focus on great power competition with Russia and China. And the administration, the Trump administration, was getting away from a sort of singular focus on counterterrorism, which, of course, had framed U.S. national security strategy post 9/11 for many, many years. But I think if you look back at the 2017 national security strategy, you will see that the administration was recognizing that great power competition was beginning to frame the national security lens in the United States. But the Biden administration really goes much further in that direction. And we barely see the mention of terrorism, counterterrorism in the document. But I think a slight difference is the way the Biden administration's national security strategy makes a distinction between China and Russia. On China, the emphasis is on competition, whereas on Russia, it talks about, quote unquote, constraining a profoundly dangerous Russia. So there is a distinction made in the kinds of threat or competition that we see from Russia and China. But it really is heavily focused on the competition with China. It talks about what the United States is going to do internally to improve our ability to compete effectively with China, whether that is investment in our own technology sector, what we're going to do in terms of market economic competition. And it talks a lot about how we're going to work with allies and partners. And I think that would be another distinguishing characteristic of the Biden national security strategy as opposed to the Trump national security strategy. Really, the Biden strategy emphasizes that we must work with our allies and partners, countries like Australia and others. And it highlights several different initiatives that the administration is already taking to be able to work more closely with allies and partners to preserve that transparent, rules-based international order, whether it's AUKUS, the Quad being U.S., India, Australia, Japan cooperation, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, the Indo-Pacific Maritime Domain Awareness Initiative. There are, you know, all these initiatives that are already underway. And I guess that's one advantage to waiting almost 2 years before you put out your strategy. You can talk about what you're already doing.
One aspect that I think is probably of interest to both the National Security College, but to the Australian context, is that without, as Will said, we don't have a national security strategy. We had one in 2013, and that was the only one we've had. That national security encompasses a lot of domestic aspects as well as international. It's a lot of transnational issues as well. So the national security strategy talks about climate change, talks about COVID, talks about sort of natural disasters and famine and all sorts of different things, as well as America's domestic political security, and that as being an aspect which it has to have stable and secure so that it can be strong and secure overseas. So how do these different aspects of domestic and international and transnational security, how do they all sort of mesh together into the national security strategy?
Well, I think that's a great question, because you do have to have political buy-in, you know, from the public for your strategy. So you do have to connect it to the everyday lives of Americans. So I think, you know, that is something that is definitely infused in this new national security strategy. And we've heard a lot about foreign policy for the, you know, middle class of America. And so I think that that is something that the Biden administration pays particular attention to, is ensuring that the American public will buy in to the strategy. And I think there also is a connection made about the importance of the Indo-Pacific region, how it's, you know, constitutes, you know, 2/3 of all the trade that's happening globally, and that, you know, it really is the focal point for the economics and trade investment that is happening and that is important for the United States. So I think it does make the case for why the U.S. needs to focus on this region and why the U.S. needs to compete effectively with China. And so I think there are specific things that the U.S. is doing to be able to shore up our own industries, particularly critical and emerging technologies. If you look at the CHIPS Act that was recently passed, which calls for investing, you know, over $50 billion in our semiconductor industries. I think that's the way that you tie what's happening domestically and, you know, how is this going to benefit the average American, and why it's necessary for the U.S. to compete on the international stage, to be engaged, to develop its partnerships and alliances. You've got to make that connection. And I think this national security strategy that was just released does a pretty good job of doing that.
Yeah, I suppose I'm not sure if it's a fairly new feature, but it feels like a new feature to have this really blurred, kind of bleeding in between the international and domestic spheres. It must make designing a strategy like this with all the myriad of stakeholders quite difficult. I mean, Australia, we have to contend with, what we think is a lot of issues with different jurisdictions and our federation. But in America, you know, 50 states, it's kind of mind-boggling to think about the breadth of stakeholders. You know, you mentioned the different industries that are affected by some of these policies. I mean, from your experience being involved in the design of the previous national security strategy, I mean, is there a fair amount of consultation like domestically within, with other state jurisdictions and those sorts of things? Or is it really a creature, kind of a top-down creature of executive authority, a strategy like this?
I think it really is, comes from the top, from the executive. Mm. But I think with, the Domestic Policy Council office in the White House, that's where you would get the mediation of sort of what the average American is thinking or cares about. They would sort of mediate that input into the national security strategy. I think that's the way it would happen because, after all, the national security staff is not that big. Mm. It's a fairly, tight organization. And so there's really not the ability to sort of, be going out and consulting with each individual of, the 50 states. But I think that the way that input comes in would be through the Domestic Policy Council, which would, have their pulse on what's happening at the political level and, among the different states. So, yeah, I think that's really how it happens. It is an intensive effort to draft these national security strategies because you are sort of coordinating, all of the U.S. government. And you can imagine that, each of the offices and regions has their particular interests and things they want to make sure get in there. But it's quite a light document. Mm. So you can imagine there's a lot of editing and paring down and really prioritizing what gets put in there. And then you have people who count the number of times, China's mentioned or, whatever country or issue. And people spend a lot of time looking at, what is mentioned or what's in there that wasn't in the previous document and vice versa.
Yeah, a lot of scrutiny going on there. I suppose you mentioned the domestic political aspect. I'm interested to perhaps on your views of how much bipartisan consensus there's likely to be around this strategy, or whether you see, particularly in the Republican Party, which is, to external observers, I think it would be fair to say is being pulled in multiple different directions, whether you see particular issues that might be addressed very, very differently by a future hypothetical Republican administration, or again, whether is there a high degree of kind of bipartisanship around what's being laid out here?
I think on China, there is a strong degree of bipartisanship. I think people were surprised. I think they believed that the Biden administration would change its approach to China. But there's more continuity than change. If you look at the export controls, well, in fact, we just saw the Biden administration implement very stringent export controls on China's semiconductor industry, which will have widespread impact on China. So I think there is actually much more continuity than change from the Trump administration. And I think if you go to Congress, you see there's bipartisan support for taking this tougher approach toward China and competing. And there's recognition, I think, both among Democrats and Republicans, that the policy of trying to reach out to China, to integate it into the global trading system, would somehow moderate their behavior, make them a responsible global player. That idea is gone. Mm. And, that's bipartisan. So I think that you would find a lot of support on both sides of the aisle for the approach to China that this national security strategy takes. Where you might see some difference could be the Russia piece. And here, we have seen some, fracturing over how some of the Republican Party, a small portion of the Republican Party, I would say, but views U.S. Providing so much military support to the Ukrainians. There's been, some questions raised. Should the U.S. really be providing this much, billions in military support when we have our own interests and needs in the United States? So there could be a slightly different approach on the Russia issue. Of course, climate change. I don't think you'll see as much of a focus on climate change in a potential Republican administration moving forward. And I know that's probably frustrating for our allies and partners who, I think a country like Australia probably really welcomes the focus on climate change that is in this document. And so that might be frustrating to some if we see, a Republican administration kind of going backwards on that topic. I think you won't see a complete reversal because I think there is growing bipartisan awareness of the critical issue of climate change and the connection to national security. But you probably would see some changes around the edges and sort of less investment, less, U.S. dollars going toward climate change mitigation.
To build on the theme of China, as you were just discussing, to what extent do you think some of these aspects of the national security strategy, such as climate change, which are threats sort of in their own right, apart from what China may or may not do, how much do you think that China competition language has been utilized to gain bipartisan support for what might otherwise have been more controversial, non-bipartisan issues?
That's a really interesting question because, we're seeing now that the climate change technologies, things like electric batteries or batteries for electric cars, rather, a lot of the technology is in China, or the supply chains are connected to China for these climate change technologies. So, we're thinking about diversifying those supply chains and what we can do so we're not reliant on China for climate change technologies. So that does add an interesting aspect to the debate that I think Republicans will have to pay attention to, and particularly as these investments move forward, and we see what's happened with the solar industry And, you know, nobody wants to see China dominating the solar panel industry. And we have seen some diversification and the U.S. Putting effort into that. There was a major investment by the U.S. in establishing a solar panel plant in India, which is a strategic partner of the United States. So I think that will probably bring in more Republican support than you would have otherwise when you actually tie that issue of competition with China to climate change. And you see that this is a national security issue, and we don't want to be wholly reliant on China for these technologies, just as, you know, we found we were reliant on the pharmaceuticals during the pandemic, whether it be PPE or the precursors for pharmaceuticals. We know that China is the major producer for the APIs, the precursor ingredients for a lot of our pharmaceuticals. So it is interesting that the climate change issue is now directly tied in with the China competition issue.
Yeah, it's quite a difficult challenge, isn't it? Because you would like to think that all sorts of issues, whether it's advocating for action on climate change, advocating for democratic reform, addressing human rights overseas, that those objectives would have a kind of compelling, you know, there'd be a compelling call to action to do those things without great power competition. But I can certainly appreciate that for segments perhaps of U.S. political scene that might be a bit more inward looking, that you need to put it into that great power context to perhaps mobilize action. But am I overstating perhaps the portion of American thinkers that would want to see America turn more inward? I mean, this is a strategy that while it perhaps acknowledges a degree of decline in America's global power, is still very forward-leaning. It still very much sees America as taking a very central role to international security. So is that a topic for which there would be a diversity of views, or is there a fair amount of consensus that that's the role America should be playing?
I think there still is an isolationist thread running through both the Republican and Democratic parties. I think a lot of it was based on, you know, America's wars overseas, the quote unquote endless wars in Iraq and of course Afghanistan. But you know, now that the U.S. has withdrawn from Afghanistan, of course you don't have those criticisms. Mm-hmm. But again, we saw that isolationist thread come out again in terms of U.S. Support for Ukraine, and I don't think that's going away anytime soon. I do think that competition with China does galvanize the American public, and it's hard to argue against the idea that, you know, we want to compete, we want to, you know, maintain our place of primacy, we want to be the innovators, we want to be number one, we want to hold that place as being number one. We want to hold that place as the U.S. being, you know, number one in technology. So that is easier to get the American public behind those ideas and keep Americans engaged in that idea that we do have a role to play overseas. And it is important to continue working with our partners and allies. That helps the U.S. remain strong.
And there is a real central component to this strategy, a real emphasis on this concept of integrated deterrence, which to my mind is essentially a concession or an acknowledgement, rather, that the US does rely on quite an extensive network of bilateral alliances, security partnerships, and multilateral groupings to kind of exercise and achieve this strategy. I mean, looking at it, it's exactly in a way what I would like to hear the United States acknowledge, that there is a need for collective leadership. But I do worry that this goal of integrated deterrence is perhaps going to be a little bit too complicated to achieve in practice, because not just because you have such a vast range of countries with their own bilateral interests. But the idea of coordinating multilateral groupings like the Quad, or whether it's mobilizing things like AUKUS to be part of this kind of large scheme of integrated deterrence, does strike me as being a pretty complicated exercise. I'd be interested in kind of your reactions to that task that this strategy has kind of set for the US government of achieving that quite extensive coordination.
Well, I think it was important that the Biden administration explain what integrated deterrence is, because there were so many questions. The phrase was thrown out there last year, but little explanation on what it meant. So I think devoting an entire page to explaining what integrated deterrence is was very important. And, you know, there's really two aspects here that we're talking about. We're talking about integrated deterrence in that it's not just relying on military tools to deter other countries from taking aggressive action. You also want to rely on economic tools like sanctions. You want to rely on diplomacy and partnerships and alliances. So I think it explains this idea that it's a whole government approach to deterring other actors from taking aggressive action. But it's also about integrated deterrence with our allies and partners and bringing countries closer to the U.S., giving countries capabilities they need to play this role in deterrence. And this is what AUKUS is all about. It's not only providing Australia that technology for nuclear propulsion submarines that are more stealthy, more able to do operations and give Australia greater reach, but also that pillar two of working together on advanced capabilities, whether it's AI, quantum, electronic warfare, undersea capabilities. And it's the U.S. saying, we can't do this alone. We cannot deter both Russia and China alone. We need allies and partners like Australia. So that's what AUKUS is all about. And there are other, you know, allies and partners that we would be looking to. For instance, if there was any kind of contingency in the Taiwan Strait that we needed to deal with, a country like the Philippines is very important in terms of logistics, basing, access. And of course, Japan is a stalwart ally that we will be looking at when we think about integrated deterrence. But I think you're right that the U.S. Needs to start pulling these countries together now and thinking about roles, responsibilities, expectations in the event we do face some kind of contingency in the Indo-Pacific region. And I think fears of that have grown seeing Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
We'll be right back.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
The invasion of Ukraine has really been quite the class in deterrence. It's really showing us how deterrence works in practice. But one of the things that strikes me is that to make deterrence effective, you need to be able to clearly message to the adversary, and they need to clearly understand that message. My concern, I suppose, with this model of integrated deterrence is it relies on so many actors and is perhaps so multifaceted and so complicated that it's difficult to send very clear messages to China about the resolve, not just of the United States, but of this entire kind of network. And maybe that's where kind of new structures, new bodies might be required to really send that message. But that's, I suppose, that's a discussion for the evolution of things like the Quad and AUKUS as well, about how we get that messaging right. But, you know, I suppose it's a difficult task, but I don't think anyone's arguing that it's one that the US should be abandoning. And it's good to see the Biden administration kind of really staring this problem in the face in this strategy.
In that spirit, as you were saying, Will, in terms of how do we message as partner governments, partner countries towards this integrated notion of deterrence and of countering some of the threats we're facing, is that one of the actual purposes of a document like the National Security Strategy? Is it as a way of presenting a clear message from the US government that sets out its vision and its aspirations for how to tie these different countries together and saying, here's what we want to achieve, here's where we think you need to play a role, and that's sort of the starting point for this conversation of actually operationalizing integrated deterrence, is taking it from as you said, sort of a point which we didn't really understand a year ago, so now we've got some more information, but is this that next step along the way to going from a concept to an operational plan that links these different countries and institutions together?
Yeah, I think, again, at the heart of it, the National Security Strategy is aimed at getting, you know, the whole of the U.S. government moving in the same direction on the same priorities, and, you know, demonstrating the direction that the administration is going in. But it is a public-facing document. And so there is recognition that the rest of the world is reading it too. And so that it is a message to both our allies and our adversaries. And I think that it can be quite useful in that. And I think the integrated deterrence concept of not only military tools, military deterrence, but also these other aspects can offer some reassurance. I mean, you know, there's two parts to deterrence. There is, sending a message that there will be punishment and costs if the adversary takes the aggressive action, but then also, you know, a reassurance or, you know, some offers of conciliation that if they don't cross that red line, they won't still face the punishment and the risks. And so I think that this document can send that kind of message to adversaries as well. Now, of course, we do know there is a classified China strategy document. So, you know, there is a time and a place for not advertising your full strategy to your adversary. So I think we have to remember that. And let's not forget, there was the Indo-Pacific strategy that was released in February of 2022, which probably, you know, feeds into this broader strategy, global strategy. But I think it was important at that time for the administration to release that document, which was just a couple of weeks before Russia invaded Ukraine, to sort of indicate that this is an important region. The U.S. is invested in the Indo-Pacific, and that, you know, even though we're focused on Europe, rightly so, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we still know the long-term, the most important long-term priority is China and the Indo-Pacific.
The other concept, which I guess it's related to integrated deterrence, is this idea of the kind of managed strategic competition with China, that the US believes that there can be a healthy kind of competition between these two great powers. I mean, what's your view of that idea? I think we would all like to see an international system where that can take place, but there perhaps is some cause for skepticism, given the kind of seeming bifurcation, for example, of the two technology systems around United States and China. You know, we saw this Biden's very firm act of kind of trying to decouple the US and the West's semiconductor systems kind of from the Chinese economy. I mean, do you think that this concept of a kind of managed strategic competition rather than anything more aggressive than that, is that a feasible thing, or are we perhaps being a little bit too optimistic?
I think it's feasible. And I wanted to point out that on the day the national security strategy was released a couple of weeks ago, the Center for New American Security, where I work, co-hosted an event with Georgetown University where National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan expounded on the national security strategy. And he said some very important things on this very topic. You know, he mentions that, you know, the U.S. doesn't want the competition to devolve into conflict. Mm. And the national security strategy itself clearly states that there is no change to Washington's Taiwan policy, that the United States does not support an independent Taiwan. Mm. So it's very, very clear on that point. But one of the things that the National Security Advisor said was there is no interest in a new Cold War that's characterized by zero-sum calculations and that divides the world into rigid blocks. He was very clear about that. And he mentioned this phrase that the U.S. wants to compete responsibly, mm. and it wants to support a positive vision for the future and for the region. So I think that, that's an important aspect of the national security strategy. Yes, it's all about competition, but it's also about avoiding conflict. Mm. And, after all, that's what deterrence is about. Mm. You're trying to avoid conflict.
I suppose, it's worth bearing in mind that obviously China will get a vote in how successful that competition goes, and that with deterrence there will also have to be presumably encouragement for more positive engagement, and we hope that happens. I mean, a lot's obviously going to depend on how Chairman Xi decides to take the foreign policy direction of China in coming years. While we have you, I wanted to talk about Russia, because you mentioned Russia and there is that kind of other component of Russia sitting in this strategy. You know, while on one hand there's the responsible competition with China, there is what I think it's the phrase is constrain Russia. What I found really curious about that aspect of the strategy is that it's actually making some kind of quite long-term assumptions about the relationship with Russia, kind of beyond what the outcome of the war in Ukraine might be. You know, that conflict is obviously still ongoing, but the strategy is kind of very much setting in place that it's like, well, this is going to be a long-term challenge of dealing with Russia, and we're going to have to actively constrain Russia. I suppose it's a little bit perhaps bleak in imagining that any more constructive or positive Russian partner might emerge. But I just found that quite firm, you know, and I suppose a great power, the United States, is entitled to be firm. But be interested in kind of your take on how Russia's been framed in this document.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the reasons that the document was delayed. I think the administration was very clear about that. They were going to release it earlier in the year, and then, you know, unexpectedly, Russia invaded Ukraine. Although, of course, the U.S., as it got closer and closer, knew it was going to happen and was telling our partners and allies that we believed Russia was getting ready to invade. But, you know, after the invasion happened, it really changed the whole geopolitical scenario. And I think rightly so, the administration delayed the release of the document because they knew this was such a consequential development that they had to account for, that it would have looked very tone deaf to, you know, release a strategy that was developed before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I think, you know, it comes out spot on in terms of, you know, Russia choosing this path to, pursue this aggression, trying to, you know, rebuild its erstwhile empire. and really trying to overturn the international order and thwart, you know, the UN Charter, protecting the sovereignty of all nations. So I think that making that distinction between, you know, Russia's aggression and, you know, a China that we want to compete with and we recognize has the means to really compete with the United States. Mm. You know, that's the distinction. Russia has already taken this very aggressive behavior that's disrupting the international order, but yet doesn't have the long-term capabilities to really challenge the U.S. In a significant way. Whereas you've got China, who, you know, hasn't taken the kind of aggressive action that Russia has, but still has the capabilities to really, you know, be able to threaten the United States interests. And I think it's important to leave that space open, you know, to give China a sort of different path. In fact, in the document, I think it says that, you know, it's possible for the U.S. and China to coexist peacefully and contribute to human progress together. So it's making that distinction, whereas, you know, Russia has already pulled the trigger, so to speak, and has already taken that action that is right now upsetting the international order and challenging the rules-based order, the idea that, you know, all states are sovereign and, you know, you can't change borders through force.
You joked before earlier, Lisa, that everyone tends to go through and count up the references to their respective countries or interests within documents like these. And I think we've all seen the recent sort of Twitter threads that people have put together of how many mentions X or Y got. And Australia's not immune from that. And from what I recall, there were 7 mentions of Australia, the national security strategy, all in the context of groups like AUKUS and the Quad and our ANZUS alliance with the United States. And so I thought I'd just turn perhaps to the Australian aspects of this, and particularly on things like AUKUS and the Quad, which I'm talking about integrated deterrence, they're obviously a part of that. And I believe the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, has recently been talking or used occasionally some language around integrated or interchangeable with reference to the Australian Defence Force and the US military. So it seems that some of this language is percolating in the Australian sort of strategic sphere and government mindsets. We've got our Defence Strategic Review due out in March next year, which should coincide with the final decision on what we're doing with AUKUS in terms of which platform. If I'm not mistaken, there's also a National Defence Strategy, which comes out of the National Security Strategy, which I imagine will be forthcoming in the next few months. So there's obviously a defence step change coming out in over the next 4 or 5 months that we can all look forward to. But perhaps you could just give us your reflections on US attitudes towards groups like AUKUS and the Quad, how they're viewed, where they're viewed in the regional architecture from the US perspective.
Great. Yeah, you're right. The National Defense Strategy is supposed to be released very soon. I think it was completed a while ago, but was waiting for the national security strategy to be released first. So we should be expecting that very soon, as well as the nuclear posture review, which is very important. So yeah, I think all of these documents are important and, you know, they will they'll both touch on AUKUS, because AUKUS is a very important military agreement between our three nations. That is, you know, the number one example you could point to of the U.S. recognizing the importance of our closest allies and wanting our closest allies to have the capabilities they need and the capabilities that will help in deterring China. So, yeah, the AUKUS agreement is, you know, central in the national security strategy, also in the national defense strategy. The Quad is, you know, a non-military group that is focused on things like vaccine distribution, critical and emerging technologies, space cooperation, cybersecurity cooperation, large, you know, maritime security, but largely non-defense issues. And I think, you know, India has been very clear that it's not interested in seeing the Quad become a defense alliance, and, you know, also to not worry or concern our partners in Southeast Asia, who have also been wary that the Quad could fuel military tensions. And the last thing they want is to find themselves in the middle of a U.S.-China conflict. So there are good reasons why the Quad is focused mainly on non-military issues, but still strategic issues. They're issues that are helping to shape that international order in favor of democracy and openness and transparency. So they're strategic issues, just not necessarily defense-related issues. So I see, you know, Quad and AUKUS as complementary initiatives that are both necessary in, you know, helping to shape a peaceful, open Indo-Pacific order.
Well, Lisa, you've been so incredibly generous with your time to share from the insights of your practical experience. It's excellent to be able to have your insights as someone who has actually been involved in drafting one of these keystone documents. And I'm sure many of those listening will be watching quite closely as this strategy is implemented. But thank you so much for taking time to come and speak to us here at the National Security College. And we're hoping to have you back in Canberra in not too long as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.